Maybe we should just all like smash our computers office space style and then start over.
Although maybe
do you think that would get me fired?
If you smashed your computer.
Invalid password.
Yeah. Or would that be like strike one?
It'd be strike one. I think you'd be allowed to destroy your computer. But they might give you a PC as punishment. Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. The Democrats running for president disagree over how to improve Americans' healthcare. It's been one of the defining features of the primary, getting the most time of any issue at the debates. And as Senator Elizabeth Warren has become a frontrunner, her lack of policy specifics for funding Medicare for all has become a chief criticism. So today we're going to dig into the politics of healthcare in the Democratic primary. We're also going to check in on the latest impeachment news after another busy week. Among other things, acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney told reporters that military aid to Ukraine was tied to investigating Democrats and then later walked that statement back. So here with me to discuss all of this are Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. How's it going?
It's going well, Galen.
Also with us is Senior Politics Writer Claire Malone. How are you?
I'm good.
Great. And Managing Editor Micah Cohen. How are you?
Very good.
Happy Monday to all. So we're going to discuss healthcare shortly, but let's begin with the impeachment inquiry. And in addition to Mulvaney's press conference, a few things that happened this week were on Monday, former National Security Advisor Fiona Hill testified that the White House pressured Ukraine to investigate the Bidens and that former National Security Advisor John Bolton told her to report that to a White House lawyer. On Tuesday, Hunter Biden said he exercised poor judgment in serving on the board of foreign companies but did nothing unethical. Also on Tuesday, Vice President Pence said he wouldn't comply with the White House impeachment inquiry. On Wednesday, two-thirds of Republicans in the House rebuked President Trump for his withdrawal of troops from Syria. And then on Thursday, Gordon Sondland testified that Rudy Giuliani was in charge of a shadow U.S.-Ukraine policy. And then I'll mention this last because maybe it has something to do with Trump's relationship with GOP lawmakers. But over the weekend, Trump backtracked on his plans to host the G7 next year at his Doral resort. All right, Claire. So what do the events of the past week mean for the White House as pertains to impeachment?
Well, it hasn't been good.
Claire Malone.
Just that. That's it. Pay me my money now. So it's not good on a couple of fronts. The fact that all of these State Department people, Fiona Hill, Gordon Sondland, the fact that they're testifying is sort of prong one of screwing over the White House's strategy. A couple of weeks ago, the White House counsel sent this note to Congress that basically said, we're not complying with any of your subpoenas and we're telling all of our people not to comply with your subpoenas. Well, a bunch of State Department employees complied with the subpoenas. So that's bad for the Trump White House on just a impeachment strategy thing, because their whole thing has been, this is all completely unconstitutional and none of our people will cooperate. So that's very bad for them. The fact that Giuliani is reportedly under criminal investigation because of the Ukraine stuff is bad, just is. It's been a bad week for the Trump White House on a number of fronts. I mean, I think perhaps the John Bolton thing was the most striking to many people when he called Giuliani a hand grenade who's going to blow everybody up, according to Fiona Hill. John Bolton is no
liberal.
No liberal, or I wouldn't call him sort of a normal actor in a government. He is a guy who has some pretty extreme theories about, you know, he believes in the value of a first strike nuclear attack by the U.S. Like, he's not a person who is afraid of perhaps going against certain norms, right? But I guess that would be policy norms. But he was very wary and told subordinates, you should beware of Rudy Giuliani and what he's doing here with Ukraine, because it's obviously screwed up. And the fact that he was willing to say that, and the fact that this has all come out pretty quickly, does not bode well for the strategic elements of the White House plan.
Some of the news that came out this past week from D.C. didn't directly pertain to impeachment, but more relationships within the Republican Party. Did the rebuke of congressional Republicans on Syria or Trump backtracking on the G7 tell us much new about the relationship between Trump and the GOP, or are those things that they always would have rebuked him for?
No, I think there was evidence there of Trump's standing deteriorating among congressional Republicans, or just more generally of his standing deteriorating. So for one, he backed down really quickly on the G7 summit, which shows a level of weakness that now, look, maybe he always would have been weak enough that he would have had to back down. But certainly in this case, they didn't feel they had the strength to kind of maintain that position.
Yeah.
Which
it was a pretty flagrant flaunting of.
I mean, it was crazy.
Yeah.
It was like laughably flagrant.
I mean, I didn't even get into the Mick Mulvaney bad week thing, but I thought it was particularly striking when this is after his press briefing when he said that there was a quid pro quo regarding Ukraine. But he said, the president, in a separate thing about the G7, he said, well, the president still thinks of himself as in the hospitality industry, which is a wild thing to say.
Yeah.
Because the whole point is that you're supposed to like divest yourself of those interests and not to be self-dealing and not to think of yourself as the owner of hotels and resorts off which you profit. But that was just, you know, pretty bad, I think.
But actually, the Mulvaney news, I thought, was the biggest news of the week, where we were talking about it in Slack, and I used the term like forced retreat, which I think is what it probably was originally meant as, where he said essentially, oh, there was a quid pro quo, but it was to get Ukraine to investigate corruption in the 2016 election, right? So it seemed like he was trying to draw this distinction between, hey, we were just trying to get them to investigate corruption and 2016, not Biden and not Democrats.
The notion of Trump being sternly anti-corruption, I think, might be a bridge too far to sell for people. But I might slightly push back and say I think the big story is GOP's willingness to break with Trump on some issues that are maybe not Ukraine per se, but are certainly on the periphery of it, or kind of tie into like the political moment overall. You know, I mean, there are a lot of debates that you kind of can get on about, like, hey, has it always been this way? You kind of have Republicans dipping half a toe in the waters of criticizing Trump, and they kind of pull back. But I don't know. I mean, that Syria vote was a serious rebuke in the House. You have had kind of more Republicans openly talking about impeachment, although sometimes when they do, they then have to retire from Congress, potentially.
And you're specifically referring to a Florida congressman.
Lawrence Francis Rooney III is a congressman from Florida, Francis Rooney, who said, I'm thinking about impeachment, and then a couple days later announced he was not running for re-election. It's not a competitive district, but still you have people kind of dropping off the kind of face of the political map rather than having to support the president. Look, if you have to go out time and time again to your constituents, and by the way, Republican senators in competitive seats like Cory Gardner of Colorado, even Joni Ernst of Iowa, are seeing actually a lot of hits to their approval ratings. And so it's one thing to defend the president on trumped up charges, right, or on the economy, whatever else, right? But like, a lot of voters kind of think the president's conduct on Ukraine was wrong. They think the action on Syria was wrong, the extent they're paying for attention about foreign policy. And like, to have to go out and defend the president again and again when you have your kind of legs cut out from under you. I mean, even Lindsey Graham, who has been very friendly to the president, has begun to say, hey, the Syria thing is really inappropriate. And by the way, if there hypothetically were some evidence of a quid pro quo that went beyond the phone call, then that wouldn't be that good.
Can I ask a strategy question? Let's say I'm a Democratic campaign manager or just a Democratic strategist. And this is crass, but so is politics. Wouldn't it be a smart move to play up to the American public the danger that Trump has put the U.S. and the world in by destabilizing an area of the world that has a lot of ISIS fighters in it? The fact that, you know, now Erdogan wants nuclear weapons. Like, wouldn't it be smart to play up the very weakness that Trump has with the Republican Party and sort of emphasize to voters this one thing? I mean, I know I've said in previous podcasts, voters don't care about foreign policy. The 2016 election and the primary, particularly with the tragedy of San Bernardino, there was so much attention paid to the existential threat of terrorism and the way it was weaponized and politicized. I don't know if Democratic strategists, if that is kind of in the culture, but to me it seems like a pretty interesting weakness of Trump's, and I kind of wonder how it'll be exploited. Obviously, during the debate, they talked about it, but it was sort of in the platitudes that I think politicians are comfortable operating in, which is like, even about basically like massacres of people, they're kind of like, this is terrible. Trump is abandoning our allies. But no one ever really kind of brought it viscerally home, which is like, this is ISIS territory and Trump has destabilized the world.
You can almost imagine like some outside Democratic group, maybe it wouldn't be approved by the candidate himself or herself, right? Some outside group running some footage with grainy footage of ISIS and like scary kind of male voiceover, right? And then it's one of those ads that like gets like five impressions in Des Moines, Iowa, but gets media coverage for like a day or two on end.
But isn't the problem that it's not as personal as it was during the 2016 election because there have not been any terrorist attacks in the United States? Wouldn't that kind of equation change?
Well, there have been, but they haven't been
related to ISIS inspired by terrorism abroad.
Correct. Trump, frankly, exploited a moment, right? That Muslim ban was a real inflection point in the campaign, and it obviously followed on the heels of an event that a lot of people felt a lot of dread about.
I don't know. It feels really crass to talk about it in these terms, but it is a complicating factor in that contingency that something were to happen.
Can we talk a little bit about public opinion and whether or not it's shifted in the past week? I mean, it looks like it hasn't. Is it fair to say that support for impeachment has reached a ceiling for now?
I think it's fair to say that most of the low-hanging pro-impeachment support has now been picked. Actually, on Monday, we launched an updated version of our impeachment polls tracker that separated out. So before, because there was just not that much data, we were kind of throwing all binary impeachment polls into the same bucket. Our new tracker separates them out where it's, do you support yes or no the impeachment inquiry? And then do you support impeachment and removal, right? And support for the impeachment inquiry is up to just about 52%. That's up a ton from right around when the Ukraine news broke, when it was at about 37%. Support for impeachment and removal, though, is a little lower. It's at, again, at about midday Monday, 48%, which is up from about 40, 41% just when about the Ukraine story broke, but it's not up as much as support for the inquiry. And both numbers, I think, have sort of flattened off in the last few days. I would be careful making too much out of the projecting the trend forward that much because it's such a news-driven story.
But yeah, news has kept coming out, right?
Yeah, but like, look, the default has been that it's hard for news to move the numbers on President Trump. And relative to other things, these numbers have moved pretty fast over the course of the past almost a month since this kind of story really blew up. I mean, I do think Democrats are having a lot of these hearings behind closed doors, so there aren't the big climactic moments necessarily. Things are usually pretty crazy for Trump in a typical week. So the question is like the replacement levels we call it in sports analysis where like the default is already pretty high. So you can have a week where there's lots of really negative news for the president. And is that enough to kind of break through above and beyond how crazy last week was or whatever? Democrats at some point have to decide we had a very good Act One. Do we want to still let Act One play out or do we want to turn to Act Two where there's more focused messaging, where there's maybe some more public hearings, right? Or do they feel like, okay, things are still so chaotic that like let's let it play out for another week or so?
I think it's an interesting, so I've been thinking mostly about impeachment as like a teleplay basically, right? And the Republican side has been getting a lot of action on screen this week and it's not good for them. But the one thing that I think that could, as Nate says, undermine Democrats in some way is like a lot of the big news is behind closed doors. We get the standard pictures of photographs of these whatever State Department people walking in and out, and then we get these explosive quotes. But as we've learned from the past couple of years, the things that stick in the public's mind are the TV things, the big hearings, Michael Cohen saying whatever, right?
But they could still have those.
I guess what I'm wondering is, as a Democrat, you realize that a lot of these hearings have to be behind closed doors for a while. What's your public strategy? What's your television strategy? What's your PR strategy? Do you have Pelosi get behind a podium? Do you just put Pelosi on the news all the time? Like, I don't think that's her style. So I'm sort of interested in what the long-term plan is for selling it.
So it's interesting. Much of the news the last week, you had all these people testify from the State Department behind closed doors. And a lot of the news that was coming out was like about the quote unquote like shadow operation.
Yeah, shadow policymakers for Ukraine.
Right, exactly. It was like essentially Trump had apparently outsourced Ukraine policy to like Giuliani and this like shadow State Department. And there was like all this outrage on the left and reporting generally and reporting on the left about that. And I was sort of like, how did this become the story? It might not be good for a president to sort of like give the policymaking apparatus to people who don't know how to use it, but it's certainly within a president's power. So for a few days, I was like, why are they so focused on this? One, they could just be making a mistake in thinking that the general public cares deeply about who has power at the State Department. I think that's wrong. But I actually think what's going on is that's not all Democrats are getting from these witnesses. Democrats, I would bet, are getting testimony that hits directly at the substance of the allegations against Trump. That is, that he used his power to enrich his own political prospects. And I think they're holding off on leaking that now because it's to their benefit to have an act two, essentially.
To accumulate, facts a la the Mueller report. Yeah, I think the Giuliani stuff is coming out because Giuliani is sort of widely seen as being erratic, however you want to put it. And so the idea that the president was putting policymaking into the hands of a person who was following a conspiracy theory down the garden path, basically, I guess, you know, is supposed to hit at his credibility. But
sure. But to your point earlier, like if you're a Democrat.
But yeah, you're right. The second, what's the second act? We drop right. this bomb and here's the whatever, the Ukraine report.
I mean, there's also an element of arguably self-destructive behavior by the president. I mean, the G7 thing was, although he rescinded it, was very strange.
It was bonkers.
It's like, clearly this is going to be something that no one's going to be happy about, right? It's not a story that has kind of the ongoing angles that you would with Ukraine or Syria, but like, why are you doing that? Why are you kind of publishing this photo of Nancy Pelosi and you where all the kind of people in your cabinet are like kind of cringing at the moment, right? Why are you publishing this letter you sent to Turkey where you sound like you're 8 years old?
Well, I wonder if Trump and the White House generally maybe doesn't appreciate the extent to which things have changed from a year ago or 2 years ago. You know, the New York Times has this report out essentially that Trump expected Democrats to criticize the G7 choice, but he didn't expect to hear it from Republicans. And that once he started hearing it from Republicans, then he decided to back down. So it is, to your original question, Galen, I think it is evidence of like his standing overall and with Republicans has deteriorated.
So if we're thinking of this past month or so as the first act in this impeachment inquiry, one of the things we were also keeping track of was Trump's approval rating. And we started off at the beginning of this process by saying there's a possibility that support for impeachment could go up, but at the same time, Trump could become more popular because there's a little bit of a political backlash potentially. At the start, we didn't see any of a backlash against the Democrats in the form of increased support for Trump. What can we say about that now?
So as of this taping, Trump's approval rating is 41.2%, disapproval 54.4%. Those numbers are both a little bit on the low end of what they've been recently, usually around 42 and 53. However, that's probably not a big enough shift where we can distinguish it from statistical, I should know how to pronounce that word, noise.
Is it fair to say that there hasn't been a political backlash for Democrats?
Yes. Sure, because there's a scenario where those numbers convert. People like, well, the kind of approval numbers and impeachment numbers might move together. They could also move in a way where approval goes up. And so, yeah, look, the fact that approval numbers have not gone up is, in one sense, good for Democrats. Have they gone down? Maybe. I think we need like another week or two to see kind of what the trajectory is. But yeah, the scenario where there's like a big backlash that helps Trump is looking a little bit less likely.
All right. So as is clear by now, we're going to be talking about impeachment plenty over the coming weeks and months. So we wanted to take a step back and talk about another topic that's going on in the Democratic primary, which is this debate over healthcare. So we're going to spend the rest of the podcast on that. But before we get to it, today's podcast is brought to you by Honey. Ever buy something online and then find out you could have gotten it for less? It's worse than a bad use of polling. Not to mention, once that happens, you feel like you could be overpaying every time you shop. Luckily, there's Honey, the free browser extension that saves you time and money when shopping online. Honey scans the internet for coupon codes and other discounts, then, like magic, it automatically applies the one with the biggest savings to your cart at checkout. It knows about every coupon code, sale, or discount at over 20,000 sites like Amazon, Macy's, J.Crew, Domino's, Sephora, Target, and more. Just shop like normal and Honey finds you savings. It's amazing. Like the best use of polling. Honey has found its 10 million users over $1 billion in savings. There's really no reason not to use Honey. It's free to use and installs on your computer in just 2 clicks. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/538. That's joinhoney, joinhoney.com/538. The numbers, not the letters. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Hims. 66% of men start to lose their hair by age 35. And once you've noticed thinning hair, it can be too late. The best way to prevent hair loss is to do something about it while you still have some. 4hims.com is a one-stop shop for hair loss, skincare, and other wellness supplements for men. Hims was created by a guy who knows some men's health conversations are easier online than in person. No more awkward in-person doctor's visits or long pharmacy lines. 4hims connects you to real doctors online, which could save you hours, and it's completely confidential and discreet. Answer a few quick questions, a doctor will review, and if they determine it's right for you, can prescribe you medication to treat hair loss that ship directly to your door. Order now. Listeners can get started with the Hims Complete Hair Kit for just $5 right now while supplies last, and that's subject to doctor's approval. See website for full details and safety information. Go to 4hims.com/538. That's FORHIMS.com/538. 4hims.com/538. We're back, and as I mentioned at the top, healthcare has been the most debated topic in the Democratic debates so far, and it's a particular point of contention between Senator Elizabeth Warren and her rivals. Generally speaking, more moderate candidates support making Medicare available to those who want it through a public option, and more progressive candidates support making Medicare universal by getting rid of private insurance in most or all forms. And we're going to primarily focus on the politics of the issue here. So, Micah, start us off. What are the political and advantages or disadvantages of embracing Medicare for all as a nationwide replacement for private health insurance?
Small question.
For a Democratic candidate?
For a Democratic candidate in this primary.
Okay. Disadvantage number one, it's not popular with the general public. Disadvantage number two, to pay for it, you'd probably have to raise taxes. Raising taxes is generally unpopular with the general public. Advantage number one, Democrats like it. Advantage number two, I think there is some advantage to being for bold, big ideas. Whether those ideas are popular or not obviously matters and is important. But above and beyond that, I think it helps a candidate to stand for something.
Your authenticity score?
Honestly, I kind of think so. Yeah.
Democrats like it, but they don't love it, right?
Not overwhelmingly.
Yeah. I think that Medicare for All, I've sort of become obsessed with like the phrases and words that we use in politics that lose all meaning. And I think Medicare for All has kind of become the 2020 TPP, right? In 2016, Bernie people at the convention were all anti-TPP, and some uncharitable interviews with protesters would say, you know, the interviewer would ask them, do you know what TPP is? The person wouldn't, right? It became this totem. And I think this really cuts to, I just kind of want to say this up front, because this is kind of what I've been thinking through in the past couple of weeks about this Medicare for All fight, which is for a long time, Medicare for All was this umbrella for a lot of different kinds of plans with sort of different flavors of what the policy would be. All the Democrats kind of wanted some sort of public option, but there were, you know, varying degrees of will you eliminate private insurance, right? And I think I spent a lot of time in the Midwest in the past couple of weeks. Like, I've watched the debates. I continue to think that the real challenge for a candidate like Warren really is this idea of, okay, what happens to people's private insurance? Because if you're talking around a dinner table, not with like us or like with a politician, if you're sitting down with someone and saying like, how do you feel about this? I think what they say to you is basically, well, I don't know what it looks like. What does it look like to eliminate private insurance in the United States? Do you know what it looks like? It looks like getting rid of one of the largest industries in America. The stocks in your retirement portfolio are probably, there are probably insurance companies in your 401k or whatever. They're thought of as these stable marketplaces. You know, the idea of replacing private insurance in whatever the span of time, I think a lot of people will bring up, well, you know what? Government's kind of see it doing things, so I'm not sure I believe this. Obamacare rollout was really bad. And so I think what is the big challenge of, okay, Democrats like it, but they don't love it. The general population doesn't like Medicare for All. I think it comes down to people saying, whoa, this is actually a huge change in, frankly, the economic and I would say like culture in some ways of the United States. And it is a huge thing that I think people don't have a real graspable, tangible concept of what the hell does it look like when you say you're going to eliminate private insurance? Can I still go to my doctor? Do I have to wait in line? And I think that those questions are unanswered. So a lot of the talk has sort of been about, oh, how are you going to pay for it? But no one's really on stage when they have these healthcare debates. I haven't seen someone give a really visceral, and maybe you can't do this, visceral, like, here's it, how it's going to be to the American people, which is partially what politics is, right? It's just dressing up ideas. And I do think the big ideas are a thing. But at a certain point, you do have to explain to voters, okay, here's what it's going to be.
And Americans are small C conservative on this stuff. Sure. I mean, you saw that with Obamacare, where Obamacare was unpopular. And then the moment it was in danger, it becomes way more popular. There's just a bias towards the status quo. Mm-hmm. I think you're right, though, Claire, that if Warren, for example, or Bernie had a compelling story to tell about, hey, I know people are worried about this, but here's what it'll look like, blah, 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 blah. I think that would probably go a long ways.
Although at this point, it sounds like most of the criticism against Elizabeth Warren has nothing to do with implementation or what actual care or coverage would look like. It has more to do with how to pay for it at this point.
It's cost, and people feel like she's obfuscating that. You know, she was up on the debate stage, and I think Pete Buttigieg did a good job of basically nailing her down for really the first time in a sort of graspable TV moment and saying, no, seriously, how are you going to pay for it? You have a plan for everything else. Why don't you have a plan for this? And you see his poll numbers go up, particularly in like an Iowa poll that was out today. You know, all the things stipulated about be careful of a single poll. But obviously, there is something resonating there. And her team had, you know, came out and said last night, Sunday night, okay, we're going to have a healthcare plan for you guys in the next couple of weeks. But it is, in some ways, I very much understand Warren's position from a political point of view. It's don't get pinned down by the Republicans with a single talking point while you're trying to win a primary and then make yourself unelectable in a general, right? She is trying to expand the realm of the possible, right? It's the tension between the Overton window shifting moment in the Democratic Party and then the general election and winning the Electoral College where everyone's like, well, how are you going to pay for it? And some of that is like, you know, you got to sort of speak to like the coffee clutches of the upper Midwest. Even if you think that those people get too much attention, sorry, folks, like that's how the Electoral College is won.
We've mentioned whether or not it's popular with Democrats and the broader public. So I just want to lay out some poll numbers. And then I want to ask you, Nate, it seems I was digging through some of the poll numbers in preparation for our conversation. It seems like they're all over the place. And it depends on how you ask the question, what kinds of options you give people. So here's an example. NBC Wall Street Journal poll, 72% of Democrats support Medicare for All, 44% of Americans support it. So no majority amongst Americans at large. Pew got into the details and actually explained to Democrats what Medicare for All without private insurance looks like versus the public option. And in that case, Democrats, 44% favored Medicare for All, 34% favored a public option. Only a quarter of the general population favored Medicare for All in that scenario. Then there's a Kaiser Family Foundation poll recently that showed 51% of Americans support Medicare for All and that 73% of Americans support a public option. So what should we make of all of these numbers? Like some show that there's a bare majority, some show that there's absolutely not a majority. How should we assess what the public thinks about
it's not
healthcare policy?
The public option is a popular idea. The idea of Medicare for All, where you eliminate private insurance, is not a terribly popular idea. And the term Medicare for All, which people can interpret variously to mean either option A or option B, you know, that's more sensitive to question wording. In the Kaiser Family Foundation poll, for example, they say, do you favor or oppose having a national health plan, sometimes called Medicare for All, in which all Americans would get their insurance from a single government plan? Support for that is 51% in favor, 47% opposed. In April, 56% in favor, 38% opposed. What's changed is that people now may realize more that like that involves not having access to your private insurance anymore, depending on whose plan you're looking at. And so when you provide more clarity, then the ending private insurance thing is a tough sell for people. And for a long time, Medicare for All's architects deliberately kind of wanted to encourage ambiguous use of that term to create a kind of perception
of consensus.
Of consensus, and like, and now you
which
see
is smart. There's,
which is smart, yeah. but then someone who like took advantage of that latitude, Pete Buttigieg, who kind of said, okay, I'm not really clear on what my healthcare plan is. It's probably a public option. Maybe it's single payer, but it's all Medicare for All, so it's okay. And then obviously in the debate, he kind of comes out and is against the Sanders version of Medicare for All.
Isn't there a TV show called Sneaky Pete?
Sneaky Pete.
It's obviously that Buttigieg has read the TV tea leaves the same way Klobuchar and Biden have, and frankly, like Michael Bennett, who wasn't on the debate stage for a lot of reasons. But there are a lot of Democrats, I do think, who are channeling this thing of people just aren't going to buy into this. To me, the paradox of the Medicare for All thing and like very progressive Democrats supporting it, what's so interesting is so many people, maybe not just Democrats, so many Americans think that the government is broken and incompetent. And the idea that then you would have the government take over something, that's actually the tangible hard sell, is convincing Americans who have plummeting trust in all of their institutions, including like all government institutions, getting them to say like, yeah, government is going to take over the insurance industry. And particularly, like, not to bring up the Obamacare thing again, but the Obamacare rollout was notoriously disastrous. Kathleen Sebelius was fired over it, or whatever, stepped down after it. I mean, it was not well run, and Obama was, you know, reportedly like livid about the rollout of Obamacare.
And to your point, actually, the Democrats haven't even gotten into the conversation about implementation and coverage. It's only about cost right now.
Right.
And for cost, according to Gallup polling, for the first time since Gallup started asking this question, for 2 years in a row, more Americans say that their taxes are about right as opposed to too high, which means like there may be even more sensitivity about what you're talking about than there is about the actual taxes. Who knows?
Yeah. So that tax polling data is a little tricky because a lot of that is Republicans saying they're more okay with their taxes in the wake of the Trump tax bill. But the polling does show that Democrats are more and more willing to say they're okay with their taxes going up to pay for healthcare. But am I wrong in thinking that, especially as regards Warren, this is a general election liability much more than a primary liability?
For sure. I think it's both. I don't think it's both.
Well, let me.
It clearly is. I mean, she got beat up over that in the debate, whereas like Bernie exercises clear leadership.
She got attacked over there in the debate. That doesn't mean the attacks were effective. Like, okay, so one, those polls show that most Democrats, about 70%, let's say, support Medicare for All, even when you spell out, hey, it's going to take away private insurance, right? Two, polls shows Democrats more and more willing to let their taxes go up to pay for it. I just think that the liability there isn't on, hey, Senator, how are you going to pay for it? It's about, hey, your insurance is going to be taken away. It's about implementation. And even then, I think it's just much more a general election than.
Yeah, which I think is probably right. Now, Nate, what is you're saying that it's a potential liability for the primary. Why? Because strategic voters.
One way that she can lose the primary is because like she can get squeezed by, on the one hand, if you're a real believer in Medicare for All and you think the private insurance industry stinks and you think the healthcare system stinks, then you probably think Bernie Sanders provides much clearer leadership on that. If you're someone who is afraid of losing your private insurance, if you're concerned about electability, if you just like the idea of having a choice, then your candidate is Mayor Pete or Biden or Klobuchar even. And she's kind of stuck in the middle a little bit on what should be a signature issue for a candidate who has a big kind of policy focus. I mean, I think it's very bizarre that she hasn't had her own healthcare plan.
All right, let's continue this conversation. I know, Claire, you have something to respond
to with
that.
It's a question.
We'll be right back. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by LightStream. Who doesn't want less stress in their life? If high interest credit card bills are adding to your stress, here's a solution for you. Pay off your credit card balances and save money with a credit card consolidation loan from LightStream. Get a rate as low as 5.95% APR with AutoPay, which is much lower than the national average interest rate of over 20% APR. Plus, your rate is fixed, so as rates rise, your low rate won't budge. The online application is quick and easy. You can apply right from your phone, and you can even get your money as soon as the day you apply. LightStream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience, and that's exactly what they deliver. Apply now to get a special interest rate discount. The only way to get that discount is to go to lightstream.com/538. That's LightStream.com/538. Subject to credit approval, rate includes 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/538 for more information. All right, we're back, and Claire, you had a question for Nate, so ask away.
Wait, yeah, it's maybe for the group as a whole. Okay, so Warren's team is feeling the pressure. They need to release a plan. They said they're going to do it, you know, vaguely in the next couple of weeks. What do we think that plan is going to be? And I ask this because Kamala Harris kind of got in trouble earlier this summer with the rollout of her healthcare plan, where people said, oh, it's wishy-washy. It's walking the line between being progressive but not that progressive. What does Elizabeth Warren do with this? Because, you know, on some level, I would think what the Democratic candidates are trying to do here is basically say to the American public, the system is screwed up. These drug companies are making a lot of money. That's not fair. You shouldn't be paying as much as you are. We want to fix the system, right? We want to expand your idea of what is possible. But practically, I don't think this is all going to change in 4 years. And I think probably a lot of Democrats might think that too, but they just want to get the country rolling on a certain track, right? Their track. That's maybe what Elizabeth Warren wants to say, right? But can you say that? Can you be that vague? Like my question is, after rambling for a while, what is Elizabeth Warren going to release? And what would be politically smart to release as a healthcare plan in a few weeks?
What if she released a plan that was like, in year 10... is when kind of things...
Like a longer timeline make people feel better? Like, is the idea...
I think it would.
Is the idea of, like, your world will be radically different in 4 years, right? Like, is that what's freaking people out?
In fact, she's already been pretty explicit when people ask her what her priorities are. She's the first two things she wants to focus on if she were to become president. One is a corruption bill, and two was the wealth tax, actually. So neither of those are healthcare. And maybe she watched Obama struggle with healthcare and so learned from that. But, you know, she's actually said the opposite. She doesn't want to, like, get into healthcare right when she gets into office, if she were to get into office.
Well, it's interesting because that's kind of like the redux of the 2008 campaign all over again, right? Like, Obama gets into office, and there's this internal debate within the administration, which is, do we expend our political capital on a big, like, infrastructure recovery bill that is kind of like the New Deal, you know, for the post-crash thing, or do we do it on healthcare? And they chose healthcare, right?
Well, they did the stimulus first.
No, but like we're going to build this thing in America, right? The idea of going out and do
Yeah. Look, I just wonder if the kind of Kamala Harris parable has been overinterpreted in the context of Warren. So I think people ascribe a lot of meaning to Harris stumbling on healthcare and dropping in the polls. And maybe those two things are related, but maybe not. But I don't think we just don't have much evidence yet that Warren's healthcare position is hurting her. And she could do all this stuff we're talking about to blunt any potential damage it does. I just come back to, in the general, will this be a problem? Sure, I think so. In the primary, I haven't seen it yet.
I mean, there is maybe some room in between a public option and Medicare for All, which, you know, in most countries around the world where you have public insurance, you, in almost all those countries, also have like supplemental private coverage that
Aflac.
You can buy. Good product placement.
Not a sponsor of the podcast.
Come visit us at the Aflac headquarters and... But like, I'm surprised no candidates kind of come out with like, okay, what's like a Canadian model or something, right? Where yeah, you can buy insurance for a few things, right? Or maybe more than a few things, and like it's pretty expensive and not that great. But if you really want it, yeah, we're not going to ban, you know, we're not going to prevent a doctor and an insurance company from transacting to you in like in a capitalist country as a consumer, right? But the main way people get insurance is through this public system, right? But like,
yeah.
But yeah, you know, we're not going to force it to go away.
A lot of this is the I do understand why Americans are afraid or tentative about a Medicare for All system. I just do.
Of course.
I mean, it's like, you know, I think often what happens when people live in, you know, sort of the highly politicized, whatever, social and work circles or Twitter, like you get into this thing of like, yeah, everyone's on board with this. But like a lot of people aren't tuning into this stuff. And the idea that like more Democrats for the first time in 2018 said that they thought that socialism was a better system than capitalism, to me, that's crazy. Like that's a quite striking statistic. And the idea that like a lot of the population is kind of like, I don't know, I like the free market system. Like this is the way I was raised. Like the idea that so many of us, if we're of a certain age, including like, you know, I'm in my early 30s, like being a capitalist was always kind of like a thing where you were like, yeah, America's capitalist. And now I feel like there is this generational gap, a true generational gap with like people who are younger millennials or Gen Z, where it's just this total rejection of the moral value of capitalism in this way that is so, so striking and to me, so much the product of 2008 that it becomes this kind of odd people are talking past each other because the assumption of what the best system and what the best market is completely different for a lot of people.
You sound so old, Claire.
I am so old.
People of my generation, we think of socialism differently than you.
Wait, I have a question, though, exactly to this point. Because there are some policies that pertain to the, you know, wealth divide and some skepticism about capitalism that are quite popular, right? Mm-hmm. Elizabeth Warren's wealth tax has a majority of support amongst Americans. So why is it that Democrats are spending so much time on healthcare as opposed to any of the other issues that they could focus on that are not as divisive?
Extremely good question. I think it's because healthcare became a litmus test for the leftward shift of the party post 2016. It was a party that had buyer's remorse about not taking Bernie Sanders seriously. And so in 2017, when he introduced that Medicare for All bill, everyone said, hell yeah, Bernie, we're behind you. We're with you. We see you, American voters, and we understand you liked Bernie, and we understand you liked the system change, and we're sorry we chose Clinton. It is completely the stand-in for how left do you want American society to be. But as you say, Galen, there are other things that they are proposing. Free college, right? Like this wealth tax, which is the wealth tax is the new thing. It's Warren's value add, right? That's her thing. Bernie's thing was healthcare. Her thing is the wealth tax. I think I said this on our debate blog. I think the idea that they opened up the debate with questions about impeachment, Sanders was, that's not good for them necessarily. And then they moved on to healthcare, which is a divisive debate. I think a lot of them probably do think that the better line is to attack billionaires.
I mean, we do also have Obamacare became considerably more popular the moment that Trump won the election. And that kind of is a slightly complicating factor for a lot of Democrats. Yeah, I know. I mean, yeah, you kind of wonder if deep in your heart of hearts that Warren could just wish, hey, can I just kind of punt on the whole healthcare thing?
Do you think it's tactically unwise for Democrats to be focusing so much on healthcare?
For Democrats to be I mean, I think Medicare for All is something of a liability for Democrats. And I think they were a little cute with the kind of phrasing and the ambiguity around that. And maybe in the long run, it won't necessarily play to their benefit. But, you know, it's kind of what people expect from Bernie. I mean, if you're getting socialism, you're sure as hell getting nationalized health insurance, right? So it's like,
you're getting it.
You're voting for Bernie. That's not a surprise. With Warren, I really wonder what the Warren campaign thinks deep down about the effects that Sanders has on perceptions of her and whether she benefits from the perception that Sanders is further to her left, because there's a lot at stake here, right? Not just Sanders voters, but also down the line, you know, this podcast thinks that Warren's in better shape than Sanders, and you're more likely to have a case where he has to decide whether to endorse her than the other way around, and that could be a significant factor. So it's complicated. Maybe, I mean, what's the term, like sister soldier, right? You know, she could say, okay, hell yeah, Bernie, I'm a capitalist, but I believe in compassionate capitalism, where we actually are going after compassionate capitalism.
You lost me.
He's. Are you riffing off of compassionate conservatism?
We haven't had lunch on this podcast. We're taping later than usual.
She could use it to appeal to moderates and the establishment and show her electability. She could say, nope, this is a bridge too far for me, actually. I'm in favor of a 10-year plan that starts with a public option and transitions to vague.
What would happen if she did that? Let's say it's a fairly detailed plan, right? It's not quite the hand-wavy. That she has a plan that is not Medicare for all. It's kind of like a supercharged, super-duper public option with some triggers that could yield
Medicare.
A gradual transition away from the employer-based insurance system, and which provides for supplementary coverage, but it's a little hand-wavy about that part. Like, what would the reaction be?
The left would skewer her.
Yeah,
and
I think
nobody else would care.
I think she's in a little bit of a bind. Micah doesn't think so.
I think that much of policy is really, it's like symbolic. And so Warren has enough credibility on being anti-establishment, on being bold, on being for structural change, that I think she could survive a zag when some people expect a zig. It sort of depends, though. I wonder if the timing of it would depend. It's interesting to me that they delayed and delayed and delayed in doing this. And I wonder if they delay a little bit more, do it sometime in like December, or like do it over Thanksgiving, you know.
I mean, a couple weeks, that could...
It could be Thanksgiving.
Until
recently, Warren had no reason to really kind of do anything differently because she was gaining, I think it was who said, like,
yeah,
you know, you gain half a point every week and that adds up to being a co-frontrunner by October and there's still time to go. Clearly, the way the campaign's being covered has shifted. The way the other candidates are reacting to Warren has shifted, as you saw in last week's debate, right? And she is getting more scrutiny now. And sometimes that entails maybe your numbers flatline a little bit. Fortunately for her, they've flatlined in a place where she doesn't necessarily need to gain any more ground to be a very prominent competitor in the race. It's not like a, you know, Mayor Pete bounce that flattens out at 8% or something. She's all the way up to 25. But I think she's going to have to think now, okay, let's kind of see. I mean, by the way, also a counter story is like in the debate, our poll of the debate found that people thought she did the best job. Now, they also liked her the most going in, or second most after Biden, so it's not surprising they thought she did a good job.
But that's my point. The waffling about it hasn't really...
But has there been... I mean, half the time we spend in this program, Micah, is figure out, like, is there an inflection point or things are always the same? And, wait, like, but... it does feel like there's... So this poll that came out...
Oh, my God. This is like... It just feels like deja vu all over again. It's like, well, I can see the next, like, year of my life unfolding, and it's sitting between the two of you being like, is everything the same or is it an inflection point?
I'd call it a turning point, same, not an inflection point, actually.
Wait, but Micah, you keep saying that the waffling has been fine. And that's like, right. Being vague on healthcare policy has served its purpose up until now. But now she said she's going to put a plan out for actually paying for it. That's where the risk comes in, right? Like, the waffling and being vague was an asset.
If the plan isn't about waffles. If the plan doesn't waffle.
What?
Someone's hungry.
Waffle sounds so good right now. Galen, you're assuming that the plan she releases includes a ton of specifics and boxes are in forevermore. And what I'm saying is, as Nate laid out earlier, she could release a plan that is
like the Green New Deal framework that has like a set of goals and like it's a framework, but doesn't actually have like here's the specifics, that kind of thing.
Yeah, in the same way that every Republican plan is sort of just like, oh yeah, and the economy will grow and that will pay for this. It could be like Medicare for all who want it, and we're assuming everybody's going to want it, you know. Something like that.
Right? Interesting. Yeah, no, I wasn't saying that it will necessarily be a liability. I'm just saying it's a risk. So we're going to find out like whether...
Absolutely. But this argument about whether it's hurt her, to me, informs what she should do with the plan, mm-hmm. right? I think people in this conversation and a lot of conversations, they seem to take it for granted that it's horrible politically that Warren has not explained how she's going to pay for it, even though everybody knows.
Does everybody know?
That she'll have to raise taxes to pay for it.
Yeah.
She's falling on predict it.
Oh, my God.
The conventional wisdom has shifted according to
on that
our
note.
Friends.
All right, indulge us. How much?
So she's down to 41%.
She was too high on predict it to begin with. Anyway.
Mayor Pete up to 17% on predict it.
And Joe Biden's at 20%. That means people think that Pete Buttigieg and Joe Biden have almost the same chance of winning the nomination?
Predicted also thinks that the following people have the same chance of winning the nomination.
Can we
Tulsi Gabbard, Mike Bloomberg, and Kamala Harris. Micah, Kamala Harris's campaign has not gone necessarily wonderfully so far. Would you rather have a few pennies on Kamala Harris or Tulsi Gabbard become the Democratic nominee?
Chalk this up to low blood sugar and move on.
Harris has an order of magnitude greater chance of winning the nomination than Gabbard. Can we get waffles?
All right. And I think with that, I don't know where this went, but clearly...
Isn't waffles on...
Did you guys see the HuffPost story about the accounting firm that did a training on how women should act in the office? And it was hugely sexist, but it said that men have waffle brains and women have pancake brains. And
what does that mean?
It meant that pancake brains soak up all the syrup and get distracted by the details. But waffle brains, aka man brains, can soak up some of the syrup but block out the other
compartments.
Things. Yeah.
So, that is really sexist.
It's almost parody. I almost like don't believe that this is a real thing. I highly encourage people to read it. It talks about how women's brains are smaller and like it's just
there
ridiculous.
We go. Claire recommending that listeners of the 538 Politics podcast read an article about how women's brains are smaller. And with that, I think we're going to end this podcast. Hopefully, in all of that, you learned something about healthcare and what we can expect about the politics going forward. But for
I
now,
doubt it.
And also, Elizabeth Warren is going to release her plan, so we will answer one of the main questions here eventually.
TBD.
TBD. Nate, thank you.
Thank you.
Claire, thank you.
Readers, could you tell this was a hangrier podcast than usual?
It wasn't hangry. It was hungry.
Listeners, could you tell that my brain was smaller?
If so, leave a rating or review, a 5-star rating or review.
That should
Yeah,
sell.
People rate us. Yeah. Well,
wait, yeah, 5-star, please, pretty please.
5-star.
Who even has, when hangry, a good podcast.
Who has the biggest brain on this podcast, do you think?
Who's the largest head?
I have a question for the scientists out there. Head. Does your head size, I don't think your head size indicates brain size. Don't we all basically have the same size brain?
Claire is just getting over like...
Am I veering into like phrenology
19th
here?
Century.
I don't think that's going to make it into the podcast.
That's a cold open.
All right, and thank you, Micah.
Thank you.
My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. Our intern is Jake Arlo. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.